This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Okay. We saw some great stuff earlier today. So we're going to talk about how you can build a game from scratch. Or as the Corn described it to me last week, what I did on my summer vacation. So there's lots of different things you can do with the P-Rock. We've already seen, or if you've been to the booth, expansions of existing games. Cactus Canyon Continued, Bride of Pinbot, Demolition Man on steroids. We got to see The Matrix earlier, which is a re-theme of a game, you know, but not dealing with playfield changes. And now we're going to talk about, I guess I would say, the third category, which is where somebody starts with absolutely nothing and builds a machine. So when you're building a machine, there's a lot to think about. You don't realize it until you start. Obviously, a theme, the design of the playfield, actually constructing it, the rules and programming, the dots, the sound, the art. So it can be a little daunting at first. Just some quick background on my game. I initially started in July 2012, had my first Whitewood done about 2 months after that, 3 months after that. Kind of worked on the rules a little bit over time, and then started the second Whitewood, which is the one that's here, this past July. I went with a family theme for a variety of reasons. I always had the idea of a family theme pin that could easily be rethemed for other families by changing the art and updating some of the modes. It also got my wife and daughter a little engaged, or at least tolerant, of me working on this every moment I had. You know, the game has a deep rule set, although I don't think anybody builds a custom game with the idea I'm going to build a shallow rule set. But I wanted one that would also play well for friends and family that come over. It's really easy to get into multi-ball, but that had the depth that I wanted. One of the things I put in there is difficulty level by player. When you start the game, you pick anywhere from easy, normal, hard, or wizard. And part of that was the goal that over time, as I master the game, it gets tougher and tougher when I pick those earlier, those higher levels. And in my case, this is a solo effort. So yes, I am crazy to do that. But I'm going to show you today it can be done. And working with a team of people, though, is also a great way to do it. So if you're thinking of doing this, some skills that are good to have is, you know, you need to know how to work on pins. I don't think anybody here can't do that. If you've done a playfield swap, that's a good thing because it gives you a better understanding of it. Soldering and crimping, you end up doing an awful lot of that. If some experience in writing software, you do not have to be a developer by trade to do this. You're going to have to learn some things, but it's very easy to learn. And as I'll talk later about the software, it's very easy to get up and running quickly. In my case, you needed to be handy with power tools. Photoshop or graphics helps a little bit if you can do some of that. I wish I had the BOP guys working on my graphics for me and my dots. That would be great if I can convince them of that. And some basic audio editing, you know, tweaking some of the sounds and stuff you end up working with. Yeah.
I think it's important for you to also say where you live because you are you near other pinheads?
Oh, I live here in Chicago. I'm actually 10 minutes from here. So this is where I'm at. I'm part of the Chicago Pinball Mafia as well, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I previously did a re-theme, so I had some comfort level in taking this on, although the funny thing is the re-theme is really all about the art, and if you've seen my machine, it has no art. When you're doing a playfield design, when you're doing a one-off, parts availability is a huge factor you have to take into consideration, and balancing that against fabrication. The Dead Pit guides fabricated, you know, their habit trails. I actually offered to help do one for me, which is great. But one of the things I looked at was what's available out there. If you see my game, you know I used an Addams Family ramp I modified. I looked at the various ramps that are available, decided that one kind of would work with what I wanted to do. This is the first sketch of the game I did in a relatively low-end graphics program called OmniGraffle. And that's what my first Whitewood was based on. You know, it was kind of thrown together. I then, after that, redid the playfield in DraftSight, which is a free CAD program. At that point, I was thinking I would CNC it, but as you'll see, that's not the case. So when it came to parts, one of the things that really helped just get me going was on eBay, I picked up all the metal from a Judge Dredd. So it gave me the rails, it gave me the playfield brackets, and it gave me a lot of posts and those types of things. Some of my friends in the Mafia helped me out. Greg gave me some scoops. which was a key thing. You know, that helped me influence what I did with my design. It's nice having Terry nearby, who always helps me out with parts. And I got my cabinet from Rob. These are the initial boards I got from Jerry and Pinball Controllers. The P-Rock, which is obviously the heart of it, that acts as the interface between the computer and your driver boards. While you can use Williams boards and Stern boards, I decided to go with the Pinball Controller boards because I like the idea of potentially mounting some of the driver boards under the play field because it reduces a lot of the wiring you need to deal with. And in my game, two of the driver boards are under the play field, the lamp board and one of the solenoid driver boards, which I've mounted towards the lower end of the play field because between the slings and the flippers and the pops are all in the lower half of my design, really short amount of wiring to do. A power supply, in my case it's a 24 and 70 volt power supply. I'm also using an old computer power supply for the 5 and 12 volts to drive the boards and to drive my lamps. The approximate cost for all of those things is about $750. So I was really excited when I got my stuff. I immediately mounted it to a piece of wood and I built some test gear that a week later I never used. Because you can do most of the development right on your laptop. You're able to use, you know, the keyboard to emulate switches. Typically, when I came back to this, when I was dealing with multi-ball and the trough, because you really don't want to be trying to hold six keys down to emulate a six-ball trough. And with the test box, I built had some toggle switches for that. So it can come in handy. Early on, the little LED display was nice. I knew that I was actually turning lights on and off and can do it. And that's just part of the excitement early on is you want to see something happen. I had my first white wood, the ability at least to put a ball into play, flip it, have it drain within a few weeks of starting. The computer I'm running is a Atom processor, 1.8 gigahertz, 4 gig of RAM, an SSD drive that's 64 gigabits. There's no optical drive at all because there's really no need. And it just connects to the P-Rock via a USB. This is an overkill system. There are people running it on lower-end systems. I wanted some headroom if I decide to move to a different display, et cetera. You know, the extra 20 or 30 bucks to go with something beefier, you know, to me was a no-brainer. The sound system I'm running has a 4x100 amp. 5 1/4 coaxial speakers, you'll see it's a WPC95 speaker panel, but it's the 5 1/4 in each. Terry was able to get me that with the right inserts. The subwoofer is a dual coil subwoofer. I just love the picture of the one that was in the cabinet when I got it and the new one. And the approximate cost of these components was $150. So I just want to do is give you a sense of outside of the play field components, which pretty much everybody here has some sense of the cost of those things, what it takes to get a system up and running. If you're doing an expansion of an existing game, you're looking at needing the computer and you're looking at needing the P-Rock, but obviously not the rest of the other boards. So here's my first whitewood. It was done in MDF, which I do not recommend. It is really unforgiving when you need to move a mech because you don't have it in the right place and the screws don't really work really well after that. You can see on this first one, I have very limited inserts. They're all round. They were done with hand drilled with my hand drill and a hole saw and dropped them in there. And John Trudeau told me that's sort of how he did it. And the switch openings was with a jigsaw. I was running the game strictly off my laptop during that period of time. In the lower corner, you can see because getting the positioning of your slings and the lanes and stuff, I had done that a little more detail in my drawings. Printed it out, first did it on that block of wood, made sure everything mounted correctly, and then I used that as the template, and again, I did that for the first white wood. So once I did that and played it for a while and changed some things, I felt a little more comfortable that the game was close to what I wanted, so moved on to the second white wood. I don't need no stinking CNC. I wish I had one, but I don't, and while I created the program in CAD, I really couldn't find a situation to get it CNC'd, the price, et cetera, et cetera. To be honest, I didn't really try that hard because I was impatient. You know, once I was ready to go, I was ready to go. So what I did was I printed out the CAD diagram at the local Kinko's or whatever they call it now. I mean, it costs like $9 to get it printed full size. And then I used 3M spray adhesive to actually glue it to my plywood. And that's how I then got the accuracy of positioning things the way they want. Where in the first one I was sort of taking measurements, and which is really inaccurate. And this worked surprisingly well. I think the biggest mistake I made was there were pieces that I hadn't drilled yet when I decided to take it off, and then regretted that for a variety of reasons. Again, you know, I'm not the most patient person in the world and wanted to start getting stuff on there. I was feeling the pressure of wanting to have it here. And so, you know, there were a few things after I'm like, damn it, not only should I have cut it, but now I've put other stuff on and I got to take it off. One thing I want to mention is when you're doing the design of a machine, you get very focused on the top side. You really need to be thinking about the bottom side. All of a sudden, you put a bunch of things in there, and then the mechanisms underneath are bigger than you remember or you're thinking about, and all of a sudden, things don't work. The one place I really got bit on that was when I did the second white wood. I realized I had another inch and a half to work with, so I changed some things, and all of a sudden, my diverter wasn't going to be able to fit because it was going to run into the rail that holds the play field into the machine. So I ended up having to move it a few inches and then jury-rig a Rube Goldberg-esque connector with a control bar to remotely or offset the control of the diverter. But really keep that in mind. There are some CAD diagrams that have been posted on the forum that have, for some of the key components, that have the drawings for the underneath mech as well, so you can think about it. But that's when you start putting it together and you're like, oh, shit. In fact, my first trough on the first one was an old-style trough, but getting that to work really well with the auto-fire mechanism, and that's when I went to a six-ball trough that I had had in the Judge Dredd. It was just the weldment, though, so I had to get all the other components for it. So routing the inserts. You can see here I have this ancient drill that I think belonged to my grandfather, maybe, that mounts to a little drill press. And so I was able to put that right on the play field. And for the round inserts, I used Forstner bits. Now, every insert requires two cuts because you need to create the little lip that the insert sits on. So with the Forstner bits, what was really nice, I would create the outer opening to the depth of the insert. And then the inner opening, the first bit would leave a nice centering spot. One bit, a 16th inch smaller, would create the ledge. The biggest issue I ran into was that the drill press wasn't as stable as I thought it was, so not all my upper lips were completely level, and that became a real pain in the ass. So on the next iteration, I'll probably look at making sure that I know that's rock solid, so everything is perpendicular. You've seen my machine. You've seen I have, you know, other shapes. You know, obviously circles would be really boring. So to do that, I used a hand router. I created templates. I actually got very lucky on a couple of the templates that on the first attempt, I got a template that would work correctly for what I wanted. So then the same issue, you've got an outer opening and an inner opening. So the template would, with a bushing on the router, and I have a picture of that in a moment, would let me do the outer opening, and then that actually would then act as the template for doing the inner opening. Slightly different bushing, smaller router bit, because it's a much tighter space, and that allowed me to do that. The opening for the switches, which are 3/8 of an inch, I want to say. I also used the same template approach. I found I've tried to do it with a Dremel the first time. It was a complete disaster, and the router worked extremely well. And my router, by the way, is probably a 25-year-old router. It's a Sears Craftsman. It's held up all those years. What I would do differently next time is use two routers, because the most critical thing is getting that depth perfect. So what I would want to do is have a router really locked in at the perfect depth for the inserts, because with a router, as many of you know, you need to do multiple passes to get the depth you're looking for. So I would lock that in so I could have one perfectly set. Overall, the shaped inserts I had less issue with after they were drilled than the circles, again, because of the drill press issue. It works surprisingly well. This image here in the lower left is from the first test I did of one of the templates. So there's a touch of chipping, And that's when I started to go with this idea of drilling some holes through where the template was going. This provided me two benefits. One was less wood to have to route out. Secondly, I didn't have to do the plunge, which is potentially what causes some chipping. I could start with the router bit in an opening, and that made it a lot easier and less concerning. When you're hand routing a playfield, you kind of constantly know in the back of your mind, if I screw this up, I've just wasted a ton of work. And you know, overall, there were only one, I think there's only one insert that I sort of kind of messed up. I don't think anybody would notice it. But it worked surprisingly well and was surprisingly easy once I got the courage to actually start to really do it on the real playfield. This just gives you a little bit of a closer up on the various inserts, and you can see kind of where the lip is. See, here's where it still has some of the paper and where I started to peel it off just to get a better sense of how it was working. It probably took in real time, you know, no more than a day or so to do the inserts. You know, once I got the rhythm, sort of cranked through them pretty quickly. One of the things you find when you're making your own game is you're not going to go out and buy 80 different styles of wire. It would be really nice to have all those millions of color combinations, not practical. So the approach I took was to get very light colored wire. It was a half dozen or more. And then use Sharpies to put a stripe on them. I was really good at first making sure I was consistent with that. Not so good as things went along. But it certainly helps at time in doing that and mapping out what you're going to do for switches and lamps and solenoids. And obviously using some slightly different gauge of wire kind of lets you repeat some of the colors. Plus it also obviously makes sense that for your solenoids you should be using heavier gauge than you are for your switch matrix. And I'm doing great on time. Okay, software. One of the things that lets you get up and going really fast is there's a framework. It's the Proc Game framework. I guess maybe it's PROC Game. I have no idea. I always pronounce it Proc Game to myself. It is a Python object-oriented framework. You can also do C++ if you're so inclined. I had never programmed in Python before. I am not a programmer by trade per se, although I've been programming in variety of ways for many, many years. But I did know Perl, I did know PHP. Python is very similar to that. But to be honest, if you've done BASIC, you'll pick this up quick. If you're a Ruby guy, maybe not, because that's such a different language. I don't know much about Java to even tell you how that matches up. But the framework gives you the basic foundation for gameplay. There's what's called the starter game that's in there, which will, you know, put a ball into play, recognize when the ball hits a trough, flexible enough to tell it how many balls are in your trough, which is the one that feeds the shooter lane. It'll track multiple players. It has a score mode. It has a bonus mode. It has a ball save. I don't remember if it has a skill shot mode or not. It's hard to remember what I put in and what it was there. But it really allows you very quickly. You can go today, go download the software from GitHub. If you're a Windows guy, I'm not. I run on a Mac, as you can see, and my game runs on Linux. But if you're a Windows person, I think there's a one-click installer that'll load all the software you need to actually start immediately creating a game. Again, you map your keyboard through a config file to what switches it goes to. There's a file that you specify your switches, you name your switches, and you can literally start running, see things, you know, dots start to show up on the display. We saw earlier some guys showing what it would look like when you have the dots on the display. I'm not sure they were using the framework or not. I think they were. So you can very, very quickly have something up and running, and then from there you start to build out your game. You could do a significant amount of the development on your laptop. I spent about 2 hours a day on the train heading in and out of Chicago, so a fairly large percentage of my software was written on the train. Get on the train, write a new mode. Get on the train the next day, create some dots for it. Next day, add some sound, move to the next mode. You can do a decent amount of the testing there, and ultimately, then I go on the game to start trying to test things there. One of the key aspects of creating games is modes. Now, the definition of mode here is a little different than what many of us think of modes, which is a game mode. Here, a mode is really any atomic set of a game function. So it could be the game modes, it could be trough management, it could be managing of the lanes and the lights and the flippers controlling the lanes, general switch scoring. So what's so critical about this, and this is a great part of the framework, because to be honest, it would have probably taken me a long time to figure out how do I even kind of address that game flow, that loop of a game that's processing, I don't know how many thousands of times a second, or hundreds of times a second, and I think Eric might know what the cycle time is. We can talk about that in the Q&A with the various developers. So this priority thing, how much core do I have? Okay. So this is an example of what the mode queue would look like when you're looking in the logging files. There's a logging file that shows you every switch hit. You can actually have it show you every lamp that's turning on and off. I pretty much never do that. But it shows you all the switch hits and your own logging command so you can see what's happening in the game. I think there's a module, I don't know if it's ready or under development, that actually lets you record what you do and then play it back. I don't know if that's been released or not. So this establishes the priority of what the system does. So in the case of your display and your lamps, the system works from the bottom up. So as you could see here, my lowest priority item on my queue is the score display. If nothing else is going on, that's what I want on the screen. So as each loop of the cycle goes through, it works its way up looking for where I've defined layers to see what that layer needs to do. And it's just going to layer those things on top. And you can specify if a layer is opaque, completely cover everything below, or overlay it. And that's how a lot of the graphics get done. And you can see the various layers here. You know, the pop bumpers, the only time that's going to throw something up is if you're making progress towards super pops. As an example, the switch scoring, it displays things when you complete a combo. So for me, that mode handles, if nothing else has been done with the switch, or even if it has, you know, this switch is worth 5,000. It's where I do my tracking. Did you have consecutive loops? Did you hit a combo shot? My game has quite a few combo shots because as a player, you know, you kind of like combo shots. It kind of rewards you for making the right sequence of things. You know, mall status. If you see my game, there's a feature called the mall. It requires stand-ups to be hit. So that mode does nothing more than kind of track those stand-ups. Once they're engaged, it will then enable the lamp at the proper place to do that. And then when the switch gets hit, that gets handled, and I'll cover that in a second. It's just a piece that helps me do some of my animated stuff. And this was, in this particular case, this was the current mode running at the time. And mode, in this case, being a game mode. Change channel is one of the modes for my daughter. You have to hit the Newton ball to change the channel until you find something she likes to watch. And she did some of the nice vocals for that, complaining about the commercials and the weather. And it's kind of fun to get her engaged a little bit in that. And you can see at the very top is multi-ball and the trough management. You know, ball hits the trough. You need to immediately respond and figure out what to do with that. And the multi-ball, again, is because it's managing, you know, the enable the lock, the tracking the locks, and triggering the multi-ball. And I have that as a very high priority because once multi-ball starts, it takes precedent over everything else. Switch events go the opposite way. A switch event comes in, it starts at the top, and each mode gets to decide, do I want to do something with this switch? It could also say, don't pass this switch further down the line. There's only a handful of places where I do that because typically I want it to go all the way through. I want it to get to my switch scoring, so it creates the scoring. I do some queuing in there as to what the last switch was hit to help with the combos. So most of the time I have it passing through all the way, but there are a few cases where you say, gee, I don't want this switch hit going all the way down. Music and dots. I did some of the work in GarageBand using some of the loops and creating some rhythm there. That's really not my expertise. I found it was time-consuming. Then I realized I could use karaoke music. I know that sounds funny, but if you hear the game, I've got some good old-fashioned rock and roll, but I didn't want the vocals going on because you've got game vocals going on and all of that. So I went with some karaoke music, and for 99 cents, can't beat it. And a lot of the sound effects, the majority of them I found on various websites. Occasionally I created some. You know, there's a mode which is disc golf. Went out to the disc golf course, smacked the frisbee against the chains a few times to get my sound effects there. You know, the dots are, you know, a little, obviously, greater effort than sound. Just go back to sound for a minute. When I was looking at some of Eric's Cactus Canyon stuff, I was absolutely floored by the number of sound effect audio files there were. Just floored me. And it's not something you think about when you're playing, just the dozens and dozens of sounds that are occurring throughout the gameplay. And when you don't have sound, you know, the game sounds very, very different. One of the things I found, especially once I put the glass on, which really didn't do till recently, was how some of my stuff just didn't make sound. It was too much quiet in addition to the music. And that's an area over time I'll continue to enhance. For the dots, I used Photoshop a lot and Pixin to create it. You have to remember you're working with, if you're doing a dot matrix, a 32-bit by 128-bit screen. So it's fairly limiting. Typically I do things, shrink them down, tweak them from there. Pixin is a free program I found that actually works fairly well for doing more complex animations. Lets you walk through them much better than Photoshop. Sometimes I'll start with Photoshop, move it to there to help create some of the animations I did. The proc game also comes with two tools that are very handy. One is DMD Convert. It'll take a ping file or a GIF and convert it into a DMD. It'll also take a list of ping files. So if you've used something like Photoshop and exported each frame as a different image, Pixin does that. The problem with Pixin, it wants to start with out 0-1, and if you have more than 9 frames, it's a pain in the ass, but it's workable. And that's a great way to create the DMDs. The framework will take a ping in real time, but you're dealing with conversion time, so I just prefer everything to be already native. There's a player mode that'll play it for you so you can see how it's working without putting it in the game. The main drawback to that, and I'm sure hopefully Jerry's making notes and they'll fix these things now, is that you can't really control the speed with the player. So I often, if I'm working on an animation, throw it into my attract mode, so I can tweak and adjust the frame time there to get what I want or play with it, so I don't have to get all the way into the game to the right place to test it out. DMD Animator is a code tools that'll run, and it lets you basically do a single frame adjusting for the 4 colors. You know, at some point, they'll fix it to allow you to do multiple frames there. But I'd really like the Dutch pinball guys to make their stuff available, but I know they're not going to. It's for long. Over time, you extend the framework. Some of the core modules I've changed to meet my needs. The sound module I expanded because of the way I was using audio tracks. I want to be able to pause a main track and then go do a mode and come back to where I left off the audio. If you're doing, I talked to her there, he goes, I don't need that because the Cactus Canyon loop is really short. But with me using longer songs, that was some enhancements I made. And it's relatively easy to replace any component that you want to go. The community's great. Eric did it does have a service module in the core framework. Eric did one. He beat me to it that had an actual switch matrix in it, which is pretty critical. And he put it out there, and you know, I incorporated it in my game and thanked him very much for it. So other people are posting the things they're doing, so that community is really helpful in helping figure things out. My game is approximately 12,000 lines of code. I'm not sure if that's a lot or a little. In the scheme of things, I consider it relatively small, given it. This is what the game looks like. I can go into the rules a little bit if we have time, or we can just do some questions. All right. Since I think I'm right on time here, right? All right. 29 minutes. Okay. Yeah.
How long did it take you to learn the PROC?
A couple of weeks to get it up and running. You know, what I could have done was start working on the software first. I was too excited, ordered the hardware. So I mounted the hardware pretty quick just so I could start to press buttons and see it in my computer. But getting up and running on the software, like I said, within a day, you can do the one-click installer on Windows and play the starter game. It's not going to do much. It's going to put a ball into play. You press a button to see it hit the trough. But you can get up to speed really quickly. There are sample games available up there. There's a Judge Dredd game. I think there's a Creature game, which lets you kind of go look at how other people address certain things and handle things. So that was really valuable early on to say, well, you know, I know that mode in that game. How did they go about creating it? So and Eric's code for Cactus Canyon, I believe, is all available to go see how he did that coding. Any other questions? Okay, great. Thank you.